All right, good morning, everyone. And
Good
we are
morning.
continuing in our adventures through Gehenna. Not literally, but at least through the literature on Gehenna, and talking about what the afterlife looks like in the vision of our rabbis, in the vision specifically of the Ramban. And we're going to be elaborating more on Gehenna today. So if you recall, previously we learned that there are a number, there's seven levels, and then there's Arka after that at the end of hell. Most levels of hell, as you go down, it gets 1/60th more severe, more intense. We mentioned that there were flames. We talked spiritual flames, which we'll elaborate on later. We talked about how in some, there's different, in each section of hell, there are subsections in them. There are these batin, these houses, literally. And what happens is there's these holes in there. People fall into the ground. There are these lions that are made out of flames, which consume them. And then we talked about how there's also angels that are appointed to each subsection of hell. And then there are people who are put in those sections based on what sins they committed. So previously we talked about how there were a number of non-Jewish nations in one section of Gehenna. And then Avshalom found himself there as well, Avshalom being the son of King David. And the question is, how did he wind up there with all of those non-Jewish nations? Well, the non-Jewish nations said they didn't accept the Torah. That's why they got punished. And then Avshalom, what did he do wrong? He didn't listen to his father. So he said that since one who is Makabel Torah, one who accepts the Torah from his father, is considered to have accepted it straight from Mount Sinai, by him denying his father and denying his father's tradition, it was tantamount to also rejecting God's Torah. He didn't accept the Torah that David taught him. And so we did mention at the end that even Avshalom didn't get the full brunt of the punishment of Gehenna, because he was among the people, he was among the nation of the Jewish people who said Naaseh v'nishma. When the Torah was offered to them, they said, we will do and we will learn it and understand the words of God's Torah. And so even if a terrible Jewish person winds up in Gehenna, he is able to mitigate that punishment, the full brunt of force of Gehenna, because he dedicated himself. He was part of the people who said Naaseh v'nishma. So that's where we ended off last time. I'm going to share the screen now so we can continue from where we left off inside the Shaar HaGemul. You see the screen?
Yes.
Okay, great. So I'm just curious, when I share the screen, do you also see everyone next to you, or you just see the screen?
I see the screen, and I see one little box of you.
Oh, okay, because I see four boxes, so that's interesting. Okay, great, but it's not obscuring your view. I guess if it obscures your view, all you do is...
Whether you see everybody or not depends on what you pick in terms of what you want to see. You can just see the speaker, or you can see everyone.
Right.
So it has nothing to do with the text.
Right, okay, good. As long as it's not blocking the text. If my little picture thing is blocking your text, you can just drag it out of the way. You can do that on your own, I believe. Okay, so we said... So we just talked about one section of Gehenna. We're moving on to the next one now. So we go to the second house inside, so the second subsection in the second level of Gehenna. Ispe Eser Umen. There are 10 nations. Uchadin Dan and Yasun, they get judged the same way as the others. Last time we said that the daily routine in Gehenna, you know, what actually goes on in Gehenna? So are they just twiddling their thumbs the whole day, waiting to get out of there? So in the meantime, the angels, they do this process where they flog the people who are there, and then they punish them. So they do that 7 times during the daytime, 3 times during the nighttime. So the same thing happens in this other section, Udoeg Imahen. And Doeg, who is not such a good person in Tanakh, he wound up with them. And so who's the person that was, who was appointed to punish, to flog the people there? The angel, Hitael, that's his name. Bedoya issues him a cold Elon in the same way that that Avshalom was saved from the full brunt of Gehenna. So too Doeg was. Begin to whom b'nehem da'ari b'sin and nasa nishma. Since he was among the people who said nasa v'nishma, since he was part of the Jewish people. So then, similar idea over here as well. And it's going to get a little bit repetitive, so just bear with me for a bit. Ubeisa tilasa is be'aser umen. In the third house, there are 10 nations as well. They've done yasun, they get the same exact routine. Futamach yasun shaftiel shmei. And the angel pointed over them is Shaftiel, Bekorach uknishte mishtizim micho ilin. And Korach and all of his congregation that rebelled against Moshe, they were put down there as well, but they still were saved from the full brunt of it. Begin to Amri b'sinei nasav anishma, since they're among the Jewish people. So Korach was a very, he was a wicked person in Tanakh, right? Korach rebelled against Moshe Rabbeinu. He had the whole common sense rebellion. Have any of you ever heard of Rasalavichik's discourse on the Korach common sense rebellion? Does that ring a bell with anyone? Okay, so not exactly relevant to Shara Gemul, but I can't pass it up either. So Rasalavichik, I hope I could do this justice. Rav Soloveitchik was known for his very, for critiquing what we call spiritual experiences. So colloquially, when I say I had a spiritual experience, usually what that means is that I had a very emotional or sentimental experience within the perceived context of religious practice. So if someone really enjoyed the tunes in shul, they may say they had a spiritual experience. The thing is, though, there are people who do yoga, and they also say they have spiritual experiences. So what separates yoga, lehavdal alpe havdalos, from davening to God and from performing God's mitzvos? So the difference between them, Rasalavichik says, is that when we do mitzvos, we are doing what is divinely mandated. We're performing what God commanded us to do. But when you go ahead and you do yoga, God never, you know, you can do yoga for all I care, but God never commanded you to perform yoga. So that's what separates the two. So what Korach did, and what also, Nadav and Avihu did as well, Aaron's sons, was that they believed that there could be also a spiritual or a religiously fulfilling experience outside the context of God's dictates. I'll give you an example that is not really politically correct, but supposedly Rabbi Meiselman, Rabbi Soloveitchik's nephew, reports that this happened. And here are other stories about Rabbi Soloveitchik. It's, you know, not the craziest thing. It's possible. So there was a woman who wanted to wear tzitzis, and she went to Rav Soloveitchik to ask if she could wear a talis. Can she wear tzitzis? So Rav Soloveitchik said to her, you know what? I can see you're really interested in performing this mitzvah. How about you first wear a talis, first wear tzitzis, but only wear the garment. Don't wear the actual tzitzis strings on it itself. And then come back to me in a month from now and tell me what the experience was like. Report back to me. Tell me if it was fulfilling. So she does what Rav Soloveitchik advised her. She wears this garment without any tzitzis on. And she comes back a month later and Rav Soloveitchik says, so new, how was it? She said that it was the most spiritually uplifting experience of her entire life. It was so religiously fulfilling. It was very spiritual. Throw in all the adjectives you want. And Rasalavichik said, well, that's problematic because if you were feeling all spiritual and emotionally entwined in it, but you weren't actually fulfilling a mitzvah, because the mitzvah tzitzis is only fulfilled when you wear tzitzis tassels on your four-cornered garment. So he was using that to say, it showed that your spiritual experience is not coming from submission to God, but it's coming from a way of just interest in spiritual self-gratification, emotional self-gratification. So our salvation's point is that the only legitimate way to serve God is if it is somehow sanctioned or dictated by God. But for me to, if I decide that I want to smoke something, take a drug, or do something that's just not within the context of God's command, and I feel spiritual, that's not called spirituality, where Salvagic says. That's just called, he likens it to paganism. Because paganism, in Rasavajic's definition, is spiritual self-stimulation that is not dictated by God. What did pagans do? The pagans, there's noise coming from there, muting that. Rasavajic said that for the pagans, they just wanted to, they had their orgies, they did all this crazy Gila Arios, all the sexual morality. They used idolatry in a way to just have full sexual morality that was sanctioned. So obviously most people are not going in that direction with religion, thank God. But Rasavichik's point stands. And that was at the heart of the Korach rebellion as well. They tried arguing that it doesn't matter what God commands us. It matters what the spirit behind it is. It matters what we find fulfilling as individuals. But what's important about religion that many people miss about Judaism is that it's not so much about my personal experience. Rather, what matters is that I am submitting and I am performing what God wants me to do, regardless of how I feel about it. So that's what the Korach rebellion did. And why did I bring this up? Simply because we wondered, why is Korach all the way here in Gehenna? So now we know why. But nonetheless, Korach was protected. Korach and his congregation were not fully punished in Gehenna because, as bad as they were, they were among those who said Nasa v'nishma. Any questions before we move forward? Any thoughts? Okay. One time I told that story over in some context somewhere. I think it came up when I gave a shiur 2 years ago about Simchas Torah and woman dancing with a Torah, and somehow that came up in that shiur. So I know some people took issue with that story and were surprised that Rasavajic would do that. But I guess none of us are really taken aback by it, which is totally fine with me also. Okay.
I have a question relative to Shalom. Okay, yeah, so this is Bruce.
Okay.
So the question is, so he had many wives, and his mother was coming from a foreign country, which was, politically motivated. So, the question is, maybe she converted or not, I don't know. But the question is, was he really Jewish? And I know things were different then because they did it after the men, not after the women at that period of time.
So there's a lot of complications in terms of matching up. I have to get into those details. But essentially, there are a lot of questions about matching up how rabbinic law fit in the times of Tanakh and how much they adhered to the rabbinic interpretation of those laws. But that's your point's well taken on that, Bruce. Okay. Let's move a little forward. So Beisa Raviya Kedin Dunan Yason Vispe Eser Uman, then we go to the fourth subsection. There are 10 nations there again. The Yeravam Imam and Yeravam is with them. Yeravam ben Nevat, a wicked king. Hu de Mach Yason Machtiel Shme, Machtiel is the angel there. And Yeravam, why was he saved? Not only because of Nasa v'Nishma. Nasa v'Nishma would not have been enough. He was that wicked. But also because he learned God's Torah as well. So he actually needed the fact that not just that he was part of the Jewish people, but also that he studied God's Torah that helped protect him from the full brunt of Gehenna. Another wicked king of the Jewish people, Achav, is put in that section. Hutriel is the Shema, he's the name of the angel. Achav was saved because he's among the Jewish people. And likewise for the sixth house of Beisa Shisak, Micha is with them, another wicked person from Tanakh, and then there's Pusiel, who's the angel there. He's saved as well, and this is the last one, I believe. with Basis Shiva, I get it done in Yason, and in the seventh house, they get judged the same way as the previous ones. But Elisha ben Avuya Imahon. Elisha ben Avuya was one was with them. Does anyone know who Elisha ben Avuya is? You know where he comes up? Not in Tanakh. He doesn't come up in Tanakh. So Elisha ben Avuya.
He was one of the rabbis who went to Patras, and he started to break the. It is from Midrash, I'm assuming. And he was a great scholar that at some point he decided that it is wrong way, and he joined the Romans became against Jews.
Wow. So, right. So Elisha ben Avuya comes up in Agadic portions. So we're told that he entered Pardes, and then also he's known as Acher because he strayed from the ways of God. He came to some philosophical conclusions against Judaism. And then one day he hears a baskel, he hears a voice coming out from heaven, which says everyone can do tshuva but Acher. So everyone can do tshuva but Elisha ben Avuya. So therefore he never returned. There's a whole discussion there. Is that really true? Maybe he could do tshuva, just it was a test. Okay. So yeah, Elisha ben Avuya, there's actually a book. I tried reading it. I couldn't get through that much. But it's called As a Driven Leaf, which is a reimagining, not a reimagining, but kind of a, someone took a, I forgot his name, he took a poetic license, and he based it on the stories of Elisha ben Avuya in our canon, and he wrote a historical fictional novel about the life of Elisha ben Avuya during that period. So maybe it'll interest some of you if you want to read it. So Elisha ben Avuya, Vudamach Yasin, Dalkiel Shmei, Dalkiel's angel there. But Elisha, Mishas and Mikol Ilan, Aldahumi, Vinoi, Demand, Ami, Besin, Nasav, and Nishma. And since he's from those who say Nasav and Nishma, he is saved. Vichol Shiva Abi, the Ispachol, Mador, Mador. And there are 7,000 in subsections in each section of Gehenim. Donan Kol Risha, Beheach Dina. And the same procedure takes place in all of these. Lochazon Dinas Din Begin Chashucha. But they're not able to see each other because it is so dark in there. So we're told that all of the darkness that was at the beginning of creation was placed inside of Gehenna. So Gehenna, even though it has that spiritual fire in it, you would think that it's you could see in there. But no, there's the darkness from the beginning of creation. Now, what is this darkness from the beginning of creation? Why is there a darkness in Gehenna? So the Chazon Yoel says, what is this kind of darkness that is found in Gehenna? So during the Second Temple era, when Hordes, Herod, everyone thinks like, oh, Herod was such a good person, because when we go on our tour of Masada, we hear about Herod and how he built all these cool stuff. Yeah, you know, he did actually do some renovations on the second base of Mikdash. You know, maybe we could have brought him in for our campaign here at the shul. But he apparently added, like Bava Basra, it says that he added a design to make it look like the waves of the ocean. But he was also a pretty bad person as well. Fava Rabba Sinazal Shu Kava Urshal Torah, that he extinguished the light of the world. What's that mean? Because he killed many of the Torah scholars. Vayilach Veis Asik, the base, Hamikdash, Shanikra Urshal Olam. Because why? So the Beis HaMikdash was called the light of the world. Why is Gehenim darkness? Because Gehenim is the antithesis of the light of Torah. Because it's the place where people did not keep the Torah are put. Now I understand, why is it that Nasiv and Nishma is what saves all the Jewish people from receiving the full brunt of Gehenna? There's lots of mitzvos that we've done in our lives. In fact, you and I never even said Nasiv and Nishma. We're just part of that nation that said Nasiv and Nishma. So why is it that it's Dafka, specifically Nasiv and Nishma, that protects someone from receiving the full brunt of punishment of Gehenna? The answer is Shekabala Satorah Yihabach Gehenna, because the Torah, the light of Torah, is the antithesis of Gehenna. And since we said Nasiv and Nishma to accept the Torah, that is what protects us from the darkness of Gehenna. Ugehenemu gam hepech beis hamikdash. Gehenna is the antithesis of the temple. Shumakom elishol avdu es Hashem yisbarach roi, because in the temple, that's where we serve God in the ideal manner, in the optimum way. But Gehenna is where people go who did not serve God in the right way or did not serve God at all. L'chein yesh sham choshech, and that's why there's darkness there. Why? She'ein sham or sha'olam. Because since Gehenna is the place that is absent of Torah, it is absent the light of the world. It is absent the Oro Sho Olam, the light of the world, which is the temple. Rotzolomar, Ein Sham Or HaTorah Or Beis HaMikdash. There's no light of Torah. There's no light of the temple there. V'heim Oro Sho Olam Shem Tachis Bria Sa Olam. So why is there darkness in Gehenna? It's not just for additional theatrical flair. It's not just for the effects. But it makes sense because since it's the place that is the antithesis of the temple, since it is a place where people go who do not abide by the Torah and serve God the way that he is meant to be served, therefore there's only darkness there because there's no light of Torah to keep it lit. And it's not just about seeing. Gehenna is a spiritual place, and it does not have spiritual light there, though. So that's a Chazon Yoel's understanding of that. Let's just wrap up this section. I think we're at the end. This is the last sheet. This is the last part of this PDF. So we're almost there. The Elohim mixas hamakomash and zipper behen inyan gehenem vitzarva anshum talmud and midrashim. So here's where this is just a few. The Ramban just gave us a selection of quotes and elaborations by our rabbis that you can find in the Talmud and the Medrash that describe what Gehenna looks like. Midado es tachniso, and also measures it as well. Udvarim halalu kiyotzi behen ein litlos osam b'mashal v'chida. But this is very important. We're going to get back to this in a moment. According to the Ramban, everything we have learned until this point is not a mashal. It's not symbolic. It's not a parable. It, according to Ramban, according to his belief, everything we have read until now, it is real. It exists. And actually, according to him, it's somewhere in this world, maybe not in a physical form, but it's somewhere in this world. It's a real place. And what we described happens there, according to Ramban, is actually what happens there. After all, why else would the rabbis give such specific measurements? Why would they tell us how big the place is? And they would also, when it came to Issur V'Heter, we talked about 2 weeks ago, I believe, we talked about Chamei Tveria. We talked about how the hot springs of Tiberias, of Tveria in Israel, according to one opinion by the rabbis, it's heated by the fires of Gehenna. That has halakhic implications, ramifications of whether cooking in the hot springs of Tveria is called cooking, if there's a fire or not. So that means they believe that Gehenna actually exists. And there are many other places that there's actually halakhic ramifications for whether Gehenna is a real place. And our rabbis assume that it's a real place with real fire, with real consequences. So that is the Ramban's point that he makes, that he believes that Gehenna is actually a real place. And we'll talk about that in just a moment, how that can take place on a physical earth. Any questions or insights, thoughts that anyone wants to share before we just delve a little deeper in? Okay. So one thing, I really meant to mention this at the beginning. I wanted to clarify one terminology, which we'll see later on. So you remember we're throwing around the term, we're talking about Gehenna right now. Excuse me, but there's also Gan Eden and Olam Haba, the Garden of Eden and the world to come. Many times we conflate those two terms, the Garden of Eden and the world to come. I mean, I'll speak for myself. In my mind, they are one and the same thing. It's not that far off, but just important to know, what is Olam Haba? Olam Haba is the world to come after the dead are revived. The Gan Eden, what is the Garden of Eden? So before Olam Haba, Olam Haba is after the end of days. But in the meanwhile, what about, where does everyone go after they die, before the end of days? They go to the Olam HaNeshamos, the holding cell, the world of the souls. But just because it's a waiting room doesn't mean it's not a nice waiting room. So that is what is Gan Eden. The Garden of Eden is the intermediary stage before Olam Haba, where those who pass away before Mashiach, before Olam Haba, they are in Gan Eden. So that's why Ramban earlier actually said that our final reward is in Olam Haba, not in the Garden of Eden. So in case you're wondering why there's more than one term for heaven in Judaism, it's because Gan Eden refers to an intermediary place. Olam Haba refers to the world to come. So that was just one clarification of terms I wanted to address. The other one, need to go a few pages to find it, so just give me a moment. I'm going to zoom out for a second. Just a few pages forward. There we are. Okay. Let's zoom back in. We're going to look at another section of the Chazon Yoel now. So we just said that Gehenna is a real place on earth according to Ramban, right? The Ramban wants to emphasize for us that Gehenna is a real place. That's why he cites the Gemara. It says there's a lot of wood down there. But Ramban later on says that the fires of Gehenna are spiritual in nature. Because our fire, when we say there's fires of Gehenna, we do believe there's fire, but it's not fire like fire we have on earth. The fire we have here on earth is actually physical. I mean, okay, it has certain qualities to it that isn't like a regular physical object, but it's still tangible. It's still a physical, real thing. But the fires of Gehenna are purely spiritual. It's difficult to think that it's just a mashal ba'alma then, that it's all just symbolism. So rather, Gehenna exists, Ramban is saying, and it does exist in the world, but it's not a physical manifestation, it's a spiritual manifestation. And when I say spiritual, I'm not talking about what I said during the Korach rebellion. We're not talking about, I did yoga and I feel spiritual. We're talking about it's a kind of manifestation. It's a kind of spiritual entity that's not made of molecules. It's not physical in nature, but it exists. It just exists in a different form. It's not an ish of gashmias, of physicality, but ish ruchnis, but an ish of spirituality. Chulin yoni gehenem heim ruchniyem. Ulechein, therefore, masha amr shiyish eitzim, hakevan al eitzim ruchniyem. So the wood also in gehenem refers to some sort of spiritual wood. Why do you need wood if it's spiritual? Don't ask me. Dein zem masha lechida ela inyar ruchni, avaheim osim ish ruchnis mamish. So while this is all referring to something that's spiritual, but it spiritually is real. It is real. It's not imaginative. The Eish Ruchnis he metzias. It's a manifestation. It's a fact. It's real. Rabban Yochiyash Eishdu Mechamemes Hamayanos. And it's real enough that it's also able to heat up the hot springs that we talked about. The Gamat Sinu, we find in the Gemara in Sukkah, it's Yonas Ben Uziel, Shevshosha Asap Gator Eish Haisa Seremes Opa Perechlam, that Yonas Ben Uziel, he got so involved in a sugya and gemara that a fire shot up from him and actually burnt a bird alive. And we also, a little bit more famously, know that from Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. After he comes out of the cave with his son, they see someone who's working and he's not spending time learning Torah. So all of a sudden, fire shoots out of their eyes and destroys that man's property. So even though it's of a spiritual flame, it's not a real, it's not a physical flame. It does have certain qualities that's able to affect the physical world at the same time. But also what we'll talk about soon, it's also able to burn someone's soul, which is purely spiritual in nature. As a side point, I always go back to Dungeons and Dragons because that's my best reference for all these things. That I asked one time, I said, well, why was Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai running away from the Romans? He was afraid the Romans would kill him. But wait a minute, if he had like this superpower that he could shoot flames out of his eyes and kill anyone, you know, I thought that would have come in handy against any of the Romans that were trying to apprehend him. I still never really got a good answer to my question on that, but if someone else wants to try to give it to me, you can let me know. I mean, obviously, you're assuming that the story is real. But Rabban, assuming that it's real, you know, he could just use his flaming eyes to defeat any enemies that tried to apprehend him. So if someone has a good answer to that question, maybe you can let me know sometime before Lagva Omer, before the soul comes up again, because it's something that I failed to figure out on my own. Anyway, there is one other section here. I'm trying to see if we have time to do it. You know, we'll leave it as is. We won't do that section. So, okay, let me pause and just take any questions, ideas, ha'aros, any thoughts that any of you might have. Before, I wish you all kesiva v'chasima tova. All right. So, thank you for joining.
I'm really late, aren't I?
What was that?
I'm sorry, my computer could not connect. I'm sorry.
Oh, good. Were you able to hear everything until now, or you just got on?
No, I wasn't. I couldn't even get on. I was downstairs, and my note didn't work. And finally, I said enough of this, and I came upstairs. So that's it.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, Phyllis. Well, again, as usual, if anyone ever misses either these classes, the Jewish philosophy classes, or if you miss a contemporary issues class on Monday nights, those two classes I upload to YU Torah. And the link to my YU Torah, either you just go on YU Torah and search my name, Moshe Kurtz, or you go on the Shul website on the education page, and there's a link there as well. So that's how you can catch up on any of these classes if you ever miss one.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you ever miss one, you won't truly miss one. That way you could always hear later on if you need to.
You give two classes a week, Monday and Thursday?
Well, I give right now at least three classes a week because I give the Chumash class also.
That's Sunday, yeah, right.
Yeah, the Sunday one I don't record, but these ones I do. So, yeah, that's what it is. So that's those ones can be accessed later on. As always, I have the WhatsApp group as well for the Daily Halacha. For anyone who wants to join that, you can contact me. All right, so
I have a question.
Yeah.
The question is, how long is there any idea as to how long people are in Gehenna?
Yes. Okay, so we did address it, but it was a long time ago. So it's good you're bringing it up so we can rehash that. What we said was that there are different – this is from earlier in Shargmul, before we actually started a section on Gehenna. There are different levels of people that go down to Gehenna. So we asked the question, most people, I mean, usually the way it works is that when someone loses a parent, they say Kaddish for 11 months. Mm-hmm. Yet the mourning period is for 12 months. So why do we only say Kaddish for 11 months? Because we assume anyone who needs to go down to Gehenna to purge themselves of their sins, if they are a decent person, they only go down for 11 months. It's only those who are very wicked that stay for a full 12 months. And we generally assume that, you know, most people are decent people that aren't down there for 12 months. That's why we say Kaddish for only 11 months, since Kaddish is – the idea of Kaddish is raising someone's soul during that time period. And for those who are truly wicked, we said that they go down Lidore Doros. They go down for generation, generation. And we said there's also a machlokus, a dispute what that means. According to some opinions – it means literally for, you know, four or so generations, that amount of time. That's much longer, of course, than 11 to 12 months. But then, according to others, according to like the Beis Halevi, he understands the Ramban to mean that they go down for all eternity, for the most exceptionally wicked people, and they don't rise. And that's the level of hell that we said was called Arka, that the purpose of that level is not to purge someone of sin, and to, you know, like restorative justice, so to speak, but it's purely punitive in nature, and it's purely God's vengeance upon that person. So that's those are the different levels of people that go to Gehenna. Okay.
So the does everybody everybody goes to Gehenna?
Not everyone. We you know, we have to rehash on this a little bit.
Do they die?
No, so we said someone
to purge themselves?
So what we said is that usually what God does is that for someone who is majority performs good deeds and but then has a few bad deeds that they committed, God tries to give them their punishment in this world so that they don't need to go to Gehenna, so they could go straight to Gan Eden or to Olam Haba. But for people who they may have committed a few more sins than they did mitzvahs in their lifetime, they'll go down. But if like they weren't such bad people, they just like, you know, were outweighed a little bit, then they go down just for 11 months. So we like to play it safe and we say kash for 11 months just in case. But we don't assume that people are really, you know, we hope that they're not going down for 12 months.
So why do we assume that then it seems like we're almost assuming that everyone needs to get a purge because we say Kaddish for only 11 months for parents.
Right. That's a good point. You're saying is that if we really think the best of all of our parents, we really shouldn't have to say Kaddish at all.
Right.
So, that's a good question. So I think part of it is that serves as an insurance policy. And then also, just because they're not in Gehenna doesn't mean you can't raise their soul further once they're in the world to come. That's the idea of learning Mishnayos, of doing mitzvos, that they can't raise their soul in the world to come once they're already passed on to the next world. But we can perform mitzvos and do actions here on earth that that could be for their benefit. So worst comes to worst, I mean, best case scenario, they didn't go to Gehenna, but the kaddish you do in their memory, in their merit, serves as a benefit for them.
Yeah. No, I'm not also, just talking about kaddish. I'm talking about the fact that we say kaddish for we say kaddish for 11 months and not 12 months.
Right, because we assume most people are, you know, even if they do wind up going for the 11 months, they're not going to have to stay for 12. You know, if you remind me next time we meet, I could we could go back to that Ramban where you talk about the different kinds of people that go down for an extended period of time, and you'll see why most people don't fit into that category.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, also, kaddish is not just for the deceased. It's also part of the grieving process.
Right. Oh, that's a good point. So what
it's
Bruce
not
is
for
saying
the
is that,
at all.
Right. So what Bruce is saying is that it's not just, it doesn't just benefit the soul of the parent, but it also is of a benefit for the person who's grieving. It's also a way of saying to God that I accept your judgment, I accept your ways, and that's a part of the healing process as well. So that's a good point, Bruce. Thank you. Okay. Speaking of prayers and kaddishes and all that stuff, we're going to be spending a lot of time Rosh Hashanah and Shul, but only 2.5 hours. I know, much to everyone's chagrin. So we'll see if we keep that up for next year. That'll be my lobbying effort. So you'll sign my petition when I push for that. Anyway, have a kesiva chasima tova. Have a happy, sweet new year. And if I can be of help to any of you before, over the course, after Rosh Hashanah, please feel free to reach out. Otherwise, Bezus Hashem, may we all be judged favorably on the Yom HaDin, on the Day of Judgment. And may we all merit to continue learning with each other throughout this coming year.
Thank you. If I can't get anybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
And a good year and good judgment.
Thank
for
you. Thank you. Shana Tova, Metuka to everyone.
Yes. Thank you, and the very same to all of you, and a safe year, Rabbi, for everyone. Bye.
Rabbi, if I can't get anybody at the shul, can I ask you a question? Can I call you?
Yeah, you can call me up.
What's your phone number?
347-752-2331.
Okay, I'm going to call the shul now and see if I could get through anybody.
Okay, have a good one, Dawn. Okay. Have a Shana Tova. Good to see you.
Shana Tova, everybody.
Good to see you, Marina. See you soon, Phyllis.
Bye.